Good afternoon. It's 5:30 in the UK. And welcome to this week's What Comes Next Live. This will be the last one of these weekly shows until after the summer, because contextually, I am taking my summer evenings to ride my bike. So I'm very happy that my last guest for the next few months is Minta Dial, who is to me a polymath. Huge amounts of different interests, writer, speaker. I think one of Minta's phrases is to be an elevator, and has hosted many more podcasts than my 100 plus. I have him on the other side of the microphone today, and he's just been spending hours talking about the future with filmmakers, and he's been on camera. So I'm hoping he has some stuff he'd like to let his brain bring forward for the next 30 minutes. Welcome, Minta.
Hey, Tom. Thank you very much. So glad to be the last one. Welcome in the summer nights.
This is a man of indeterminate nationality and languages. At the moment, that was a very posh English voice that came forwards.
Ah, that happens. And you know, when you go to posh English schools, they do tend to format you.
They didn't format you. Okay, so we shall leave that identity unexplored for the moment. We met a few months ago at one of Ben Braben's monthly walkabouts in Green Park and St. James's Park, and the weather was unusually mild. And so instead of people standing around for a few minutes doing intros and then rushing for the pub, we stood around for quite a long time. And it was, of all of the many of those monthly walks I've been to, it was the best one of those gatherings. And off the back of some of your thoughts, Ben now brings a word for people to think about to every walk and talk. And I missed the one last month, last night, but the word was dragons. And what occurred to me was the phrase around bravery of go where there be dragons, and entrepreneurial thinking and stuff like that. So what's been going on in your world? This we're about what comes next. So what's going on right now, and what occurs to your brain to talk about today?
Thank you, Tom. I must say I enjoy the idea of connecting dots and patterns, and sometimes the patterns sort of appear in front of you. And a large part of what I'd like to talk about relates to the state of mental health in the world. And I want to start with a little story about dragons, which feels rather apropos of last night and of the mental health story. Because there a chap I had on my podcast, a guy called Leonidas Johnson, who wrote a book called Raising Victims. And in his podcast with me, he talked about an allegory, which I thought was rather amusing. He talked about how there was this dragon slayer out there, and he went around and he saw dragons, and every time he saw them, he went and killed them. And he became noted for being a great slayer of the dragon. And he was so good, in fact, at doing it that he killed all the dragons. And then he woke up on Saturday morning and said, "Oh my gosh, my existence is no longer worthy because I've achieved the slaying of all the dragons." And by Sunday evening, he was entirely depressed. And so he slept and then had a dream. He said, "Well, maybe I should just invent a new dragon to slay." And he went after a new dragon, and then he went after it with vim and vigor until such time as that was put away. And the allegory speaks to a notion of trying to get rid of all the ills of society. And Leonidas is a black man, and he was talking about, for example, getting rid of all racism. And so that dragon slayer, the dragon in this case, was racism, and decided that based on the need to get rid of racism, there was this title, the attribution, the performative notion of being a dragon slayer, because I'm getting rid of racism. Look at me, how good I am doing. And then once, quote unquote, and this is Leonidas Johnson speaking, not me, this idea of racism had been sort of conquered. We'd gotten laws in America where racism was no longer considered. There's ways which universities had to operate in order to equalize and such and so forth. Anyway, he talks about how society keeps on looking to try to do good and go off to the next thing and then show myself for doing good. And what he talks about is that by constantly making your identity associated with getting rid of other things and doing good, there's a distancing between actually who you are and this sort of image of who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And in that gap, there's a breakdown, because in the end of the day, the idea that we are only good and doing good is a far cry from our reality. I am an imperfect being.
Mm-hmm.
And to suggest in the presentation of who I am that I'm a perfect being, only doing good, is going to be challenging when one day I wake up and find out, oh my gosh, I'm actually not that good. Anyway, so today's world, it's amazing. There's progress everywhere, living longer, well, in certain countries anyway. My children haven't had to go to war. The war has existed in other countries. We've got these magical computers in our fingertips. There's so much that's there to talk about and how great society is. And yet, in basically all the Western world, and the statistics prove it out, and Jonathan Haidt just wrote a new book about this, mental health disorders, anxiety, stress, depression, suicide has never been higher. So is progress really progress, is the question at some level. This idea that we're doing good and we've improved everything and that we're, you know, getting rid of all the isms of the world, well, at some level, must not be so good for our mental health. Or at least that's the correlation, not necessarily the causation, because Haidt is very quick to point out that there's no scientific evidence of this proof that this led to that. But we've got mental health issues everywhere. And so one of the things I'm trying to do is look at how to improve this situation. So look at somehow the causes of it. And the big piece of that is getting to know who you are and being more comfortable with that, rather than the projection of some beautiful Instagrammable version of you,
right?
Dragon Slayer or other.
Hmm.
And in that getting to know who you are, know thyself, you become comfortable with your imperfections. You doesn't mean you necessarily are going to not try to improve, but you need to come to grips with the fact that you're an imperfect being and that you have imperfections, and that you also will have to suffer things like pain, that life is actually about challenge and risk and ultimately death. And society does everything in its possible means to get rid of death. We put old people in community homes. We don't harbor them at home. We don't talk about it because it's a frightening topic. We take pills to get rid of depression. We take pills to get rid of pain. And ultimately, we're trying to do everything we can to get rid of any risk, because risk is bad, right? Wrong, I say. There's an expression I like to trot out. It's a little bit provocative, but bear with me.
Mm-hmm.
An adventure without risk is actually not an adventure.
Mm-hmm.
Life without adventure is actually not a life. And in a society where we are, in the next year, it's estimated that we will spend $640 billion in anti-aging, anti-senescence, and anti-death medication technologies, transhumanism gone on steroids, if you will. Well, $640 billion on trying to avoid reality.
Mm-hmm.
That day after day, we get older, and that is our journey. Mm-hmm. And at the end, we die.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it shines a light on the present, on the life of today. Anyway, that's a a long introduction. And what is the recipe? Well, amongst the recipe, you have to work on figuring out who you are and accepting your imperfections. And the root to that, in my opinion, is having strong, meaningful conversations. Not conversations about the football match of last night, although that even can be existentially interesting. But the vast majority of conversations either are haughty impersonalization of who you might be or wish to be, or totally superficial numbskullery, or horribly conflictual, controversial, and nasty.
Yeah.
Lacking in civility. So let us return to an ability, and this is just a monologue, Tom, right? But let us return to an ability to have meaningful conversations that bump up against the frontiers of who you are, challenge your perception of self, allow yourself to be constantly in learning mode, learning to listen to others, not just pontificate, which I could quickly be challenged for doing, but get into and have time for more meaningful conversations. Be prepared to take the risk to express your true beliefs, not the ones you think you need to say performatively and societally, and enjoy listening to others. So this is my impulsion, and I think we need to have more meaningful conversations at work about, for example, what do you truly believe, your values. It's not just about the result, because the ends don't justify the means. Talk about values, talk about purpose, but not just,
not trite, no.
Trite purpose. Then at home, let's encourage, not if we can insist on having family dinners where there is no technology on board. When you don't know the answer to something, you don't snap the telephone, Google it up and all. You continue to confront the fact you don't know it, that your brain didn't retrieve the information. And you go with that, and you have these conversations that are deeply human and normal and messy, and encourage having sparky conversations on difficult topics, not just, what did you do today, honey? Speaking about with your wife or your spouse or your child or whatever. And have more meaty conversations, do it with strangers, and risk putting yourself out there. I mean, we've kind of got this riskless, we're risk averse. You can see it in so many elements. And certainly, I think it underpins how most Western countries approached COVID. And you can see the scars today, still today, where we don't want to have any pain. We don't want to have any death. And for me, it is my belief that this lack of acceptance has what stimulated the mental health issues we have today.
For the audio listeners, the dead air is me processing as if I pull that together a little bit. So is progress really progress when we have record numbers of mental health issues? And I love the piece you've anchored upon, which is going back to, for students of philosophy, Socrates, know thyself. So coming to grips with imperfections, life is pain if you're a Buddhist. Right? So, and getting rid of risk. I do completely align with everything you're saying, and a couple of personal expressions of that. One is that in my early 20s, I grew up in the UK, then I moved overseas when I was 24. But in my early 20s, I did a lot of hitchhiking around Europe and cheap adventures, right? Because I'm 1.90 meters tall and 100 kilos. So it's like, I'm not going to get harassed too much. But the ones I remember, the stories I can tell, are where everything went wrong. Right. So if you do something where everything is controlled, you're a tourist. If you do things where things go wrong, or the opportunities for things to go wrong within boundaries, within, you still feel relatively safe, hopefully, you're a traveler. Or in your words, an adventure without risk is not an adventure. Life without adventure is not a life. So completely aligned with you on all of that. My other personal one is that my favorite watch is, I have a lot of watches. I don't collect big expensive watches. I collect watches I just like. Was an inexpensive watch from a London watchmaker called Mr. Jones Watches. And it's the title of the watch, they're done by a graphic artist, right? The title of the watch is called The Accurate. And it, on the two hands of the analog watch, on one of the hands, it says, remember. If you're, as I'm sure you're a student of the Roman Stoics, what do you think the, what might say on the other hand? It says, you will die. Which in the Stoics is memento mori. My favorite watch. I've had it for many years, and I'm a student of the Stoics. And just over 2 years ago, I was unexpectedly diagnosed with cancer.
It's rarely expected, you know. But...
Well, I had no symptoms. So it was out of a screening program. So I was asymptomatic. They said, we're going to have your colon out, and you're going to have, well, half your colon out. And then by the way, you're going to have chemotherapy and all of this stuff. And I just found it quite fascinating to be able to draw upon, at some level, having worked as a coach for many years and tried to go where places I wouldn't want to take my clients, right? So always go further than you used to take your clients. Relatively, I am certainly an imperfect being. And I've done a lot of work on knowing who I am. And I've found, for example, the language around cancer is based upon people not wanting to confront pain and fear. The language people use who are not going through cancer is to their friends and family, because they don't want to face this difficult conversation, is all around fighting it, and you're a warrior and you're a battle. And I thought, what's that saying to all the people who will not come through? So my I wrote extensively about it. I had a daily blog for 7 years. And for that period of time, I wrote a lot about my experience and what I felt and what was going on for me. But I felt really well equipped, because I feel I know myself to a large extent, and I could talk about what it felt like. And my language was always in the positive framing. I referred to it as a health journey. And what am I learning about myself through this? What does it mean to me? Would I be okay if I did die? As it happens, for the audience, I am in very good health. I have the sword of Damocles hanging over me for life. It could come back, and if it does, it's not good, right? But it's, you know, into every life some rain must fall, right? But it was the memento mori was the anchor. It's like, well, it is what it is. And it's not stoic in a defeatist sense. It's stoic. Memento mori to me is one of the most powerfully positive phrases in the world, because it's all about, remember, you will die. Live now. Live for the moment. Have real, meaningful conversations. Don't just be vacuous. Don't be superficial. So I do love the fact that the reasoning behind you coming, saying, here's a word to talk about, is because people don't just go, so what do? Oh, are you busy? My own personal introduction, if I do get dragged to a networking event and I don't like superficial conversations, the one that Ben runs is not superficial. It's pretty cool. People say, what do? I say, I wrestle elephants, right? Because it either has people who want a superficial conversation run away, or people go, what do you mean by that? And then you get it, and all of a sudden it can spark a good conversation. So I do love, I'm totally aligned. I'm in violent agreement, as a Chicagoan boss of mine once said, with everything you're saying. So what are you doing about it?
Well, I think it'd be worth mentioning that I am a fan for, so this is for the audio people, very useless, but for the people who are watching, a fan, I just showed up the back of my telephone, which has a skull and bones that refers to a logo for my favorite rock band, which I've been following basically all my life, seen them probably 200 or so times, and called the Grateful Dead. And what's interesting about the folklore that got to the name really essentially means that once you embrace death and you know that you die, then you will become more grateful. So there's that's part of what I do. I mean, I listen to the Grateful Dead pretty much every day. If I don't play some Grateful Dead, because I love to play and sing. But in June, I'm going to go to the Sphere in Las Vegas, where I will see for 3 nights in a row what's left of the Grateful Dead, because a bunch of them die. Jerry died, but John Mayer and company will be playing with 3 members of the Grateful Dead, and in the Sphere, and I'll be hanging out with some 20,000 other similar fans in my community to listen to Grateful Dead and to be grateful for the present.
Yeah.
So that's one way. The second way is I wrote on Substack basically throughout the pandemic. I wrote a book, and I gave myself the mission to write one chapter a week and publish it. And I did that for 79 weeks in a row.
Wow.
3,000 words a week, published on every Thursday. I can't remember. I think it was at noon, every Thursday at noon for 79 weeks. And so I gave myself that challenge. Why? Because I thought the idea of mimicking the 19th century authors who used to publish in newspapers one chapter a week, Dickens and company, that was something I wanted to feel. What was that like? And so I've ended up with 450,000 words about how to have meaningful conversations, with some practical guides, including how to do that with dinner parties, with friends, strangers, and how to integrate meaningful conversations at work. When, how, why, with whom, about what. And so that's sort of my practical guide to trying to do that. And then I've got I've been following, and I've written a book about artificial intelligence with a specific beat on how to inject or encode empathy into AI. And where that comes into play is, on a practical note, injecting empathy into your communications is generally very positive. Depends on what your intention is, but it is a good route to getting to a better conversation, a better understanding of one another.
Yeah.
And it's also going to be interesting as AI improves, as it has, to come up with some form of therapeutic AI. Where there's a number of initiatives. One's called empathy.com and empathic.ai, hume.ai, and Scott Sandland has Cyrano.ai. So there's a whole bunch of these different applications that are attempting to create effective therapeutic AI, which will also deal with the mental health issues, because we have a dearth or scarcity of therapists in basically all of the Western world as well, which is, you know, sort of like a good cocktail for a screw up. Although at the end of the day, what I'm really preaching for is not necessarily to have more therapists or to need the therapeutic AI. I'd much rather us figure out how to know ourselves and embrace our imperfections and figure out how to have meaningful conversations in society without needing all that stuff. And by the way, taking psychedelics, another great way to deal with this. I mean, it's amazing all the research has come out to show how psychedelics in generally good surroundings are useful for dealing with certain pathologies like PTSD, fear of death, and addiction, and so on. So AI, psychedelics are two of my favorite topics, and both of them have applications towards helping with mental health. And both of them, it turns out, and that's as symptomatic, in my opinion, of how society is sick in and of itself, is that society tends to wish to hold to a higher standard both AI and psychedelics than they hold themselves to. I don't know who exactly said this, but I've repeated it frequently. It's much easier to criticize somebody else than to know yourself. And so we quickly like to point fingers at, blame others, criticize others. Oh, AI, well, it's never good enough. You know, look, oh God, it has bias and look how horrible it is. Huh. What about, you know, you, right? Me. And then psychedelics. Oh gosh, psychedelics are terrible. You know, I heard about the story of this one chap who took psychedelics and 5 years ago, he took it and he fell off a bridge and he died. So we prefer to look at that one bad news, forgetting that he might have had other cross symptoms that might have contributed to that, rather than look at the enormous efficacy rates. I mean, lasting, effective therapy in good conditions of psychedelic assisted therapy. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, we don't want to do that. We don't want to move because until it's perfect.
Yeah.
Well, I think not moving is tantamount to not having adventure. Mm-hmm. Not moving is sort of like trying to avoid all possibilities of anything possibly bad. Let's get rid of tackling in rugby because it's dangerous. Let's put helmets on five-year-olds as they're getting on tricycles, which it would take a freaking hurricane to blow over and have that child be harmed. And you create children that aren't prone to, or, you know, we're allowing to figure out how to deal with risk. Resilience and understanding how to get through hardship happens through getting through hardship. The muscle of resilience needs to be practiced. Mm-hmm. You don't just walk up to a big challenge and then all of a sudden conquer it. I mean, yes, of course, sometimes that happens. But on balance, as a society, we're not encouraging the building up resilience. So these, I'm preaching these things, and the new book I want to talk about, or at least I'll be writing about, is called The Avatar Trap. And The Avatar Trap specifically speaks to this idea of the this presentation of ourselves as this other individual, distanced from who we are, distanced from the reality. And the avatar, and I can finish on this, the avatar, which is a Hinduist concept, essentially, we've got it completely backwards in our society. An avatar today is this digital, immortalized version of me that's always much prettier. Mm-hmm. If you read Ready Player One, for example, all the avatars are a little bit better versions of me, you know, sometimes of me, but not necessarily. And we live through these digital representations of ourselves. And so they are better. They are living forever. And basically are fake. And yet an avatar actually is the complete opposite in the Hindu religion. An avatar is a human version of an immortal God. Therefore, something that is mortal and is capable of being with us humans, i.e. imperfect. So we're doing everything the wrong way. And the avatar trap is this idea of, oh, well, I can be this other thing. I can present myself as this other thing. And instead of getting to grips with and accepting your reality, your who you truly are, your imperfections, dealing with pain, challenge, death, and such, we are running down this, oh, wouldn't it be better if we just lived our avatars?
Hmm.
So that's it.
So what have I'm fascinated by, so what have you learned in the sort of know thyself space on this journey of focusing on this for a number of years, including 79 weeks and writing 450,000 words during a period of time that was challenging for everybody. What have you learned about who you are?
All right. Well, I'm going to say that I think it's worth, if I go back to the journey that set me on the path to wish to know who I was,
mm-hmm.
because I was living the quote unquote, you know, fast track dream, big career, huge titles and all the attributions to go with that. And I was running this company. I was basically the CEO in New York of a company that roughly did $350 million in revenues, 40 countries. And my office overlooked the Twin Towers. And my brand called Redken was undersigned Fifth Avenue, New York City. And on a beautiful Tuesday morning in Manhattan in September 2001, I turned to my right and I saw a big fur ball coming out of what was in two of my campaigns for 2002. And of course, it was a little bit of a shock, but I called in my assistant and we talked, oh, Wow, that's pretty crazy. What could it be? And she immediately said it was a terrorist attack, and we assumed it was some sort of bomb, like the bomb in 1993 underneath it and stuff. And then eventually we had 60 people in my office, and people started crying, and it was starting to be news reports of a plane. And in 3 days' time, I was to go to Paris to speak about the future of my brand, where I was to present the next 3 year plan and how we're going to make the money and the budget and all that exciting stuff in front of 550 of the biggest executives at L'Oréal. And well, I vacated everyone from my office. I said, "Hey, I gotta keep working. I've got a meeting to prepare in 3 days," and which included roughly 13 other members of my team, by the way. And then as I'm talking to Paris, my boss in Paris, I with an old phone, by the way, with the little wires that, I was always playing with it. But I saw another airplane, and I just was watching it and talking, and I said to Nicolas, "Listen, I need to I'm just going to hang up right now." So I hung up, and I just stared and watched what was happening, because I was thinking in my head this was a Canadair that was going to drop water to douse the flames on the existing North Tower fire. And of course it didn't. It did this wicked circle around and came back in, and then I saw the explosion. I lost view of it at one point. Anyway, all this to say, I then was starting to think, well, oh wow, how actually exciting is it to sell shampoos? How meaningful is this all? And as it happened, that the night before, the September 10th, my father had come to visit me, and I hadn't seen him in quite a while. I mean, really 2 years, during which time I had two children, and he'd come to visit, and I had not been able to give to him a 400-page manuscript that I had researched over the course of the last 10 years about his father, after whom I was named. And so the next day, his plane was canceled, and he ended up coming back for dinner. And I felt so obliged to really explain to him everything I had found out about who his parents were, both. So his father was killed in the war, and his wife then killed herself after the war. And through the research of who my grandfather was, I ended up having to think about more about, well, this is the man after whom I was named, but by the way, who am I within all that? And there's the genetic component to it. Obviously, I didn't know him, and he died at the age of 33. And then there's my father in all of this, and then there's me in all of this. And here's the point. Lots of other things happen, of course, for me, but I end up saying, well, I need to figure out what is going to make my life meaningful. And how I'm not going to just run off and do some sort of Mother Teresa like activity and do good. That's really what it's not about. You need to do something that is meaningful for you at a deeper personal level. So I ended up, for example, turning that book into a film, put it on television, and through the process of interviewing 130 veterans of the Second World War who had been through the prison camps of the Japanese, I figured out that I was so lucky to lead the life that I was. And I also figured out that there's a real thing called hardship. And so what can I do within my life that's going to allow me to confront me more myself, get to the boundaries of who I am, my imperfections and such. And here's the real learning of all this is I became intentional about leaning into some idea of who I am and who I wanted to be. In other words, there's an acceptance of who I am, where I am. I was this corporate stiff, living a life, doing things. But let's say now I want to figure out who I want to be, and how do I go from A to B? And that was the intentional story that ended up making me be the elevator. And so my design is to live at least a little piece of every day by elevating the debate and connecting people, dots, and ideas for a more meaningful existence. So this has helped me be who I want to be, not perfect, but always striving to make the world a more meaningful place for me, and hopefully a little bit better for others as well.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, I just yesterday I saw a mentor of mine who helped me find my purpose in life about a dozen years ago. First time I'd seen her since the pandemic. For various reasons, health reasons, she literally had not seen her since the pandemic had started in central London. But she always signed off all of her emails with the line, "Awareness is the greatest agent for change." So that speaks to me to what you were just saying about yourself. Once you have that awareness, you can then consciously and from an aware space of where you are, decide who you are and then who you want to be and evolve into what brings meaning to you. So
yeah, I think the key thing in that is that awareness.
Yeah.
You know, being aware of who you are and leaning into the messiness of ourselves and being aware. I mean, I think my journey has been supremely helped by having an extraordinary wife who has had the courage to always push me back and or support me when needed. And yes, it's helpful to have that kind of relationship on the journey. I think it'd be worth finishing, or I don't know if it has to be finished, but I recently interviewed a man who, and it speaks to what you were talking about before about cancer. So he's a medical doctor, and he was a normal, I can't remember what sort of doctor, but let's say a normal doctor. And but he wasn't earning enough because he had to pay for a mortgage and maybe the children in college or something. So he ended up moonlighting and did some extra work on the weekends at a hospice center nearby in Buffalo, New York. And he discovered a whole new world. And he realized that it's extraordinary how the medical community and all his medical training had been all about doing and healing. You know, you got a bad thing, let me go after it. Let me do something about that. And at school, in the United States anyway, all his school would be about learning how to treat certain maladies and pathologies. And as soon as anyone was, oh, well, this person's not going to make it, they would then just say, oh, well, there's nothing more to do here, and then move along. So there was absolutely no discussion around death and the handling of death at medical school. It's only about doing good and improving the situation of the disease. If you can't do anything about it, there's no worth. So what does that say for anyone who's dying? And so he basically quit being a doctor. He became a hospice doctor. And for the last 25 years, he has been intent and looking how to comfort people as they move towards death. And look what happens in those instances. And so I interviewed him about this idea of having the last conversations. What's important? And there are several things that are important in that. But the one thing that has to be pulled out is that the only thing that matters, Tom, in our lives actually are our relationships.
Yeah.
It ain't about the house or the swank, you know, watches even. It's really just about our relationships. There's the relationship with yourself, and that has, of course, a massive impact on how you are with others. And then there's just the relationships. And are we spending the time having those conversations, going out for the beer, listening to others, not just having to tell them about your experience, but listening into their experiences, learning from them, connecting with them. And because at the end of our lives, that's apparently the only thing we worry about.
Yeah. Very, very cool. Well, I feel like this conversation is getting progressively more and more meaningful, and we could go on for hours. But I'm also cognizant of the fact I tend to keep these to roughly half an hour, and that you've done four.
It is I who have erred. It is I who have waxed on. And
it's wonderful. So it was a pleasure to meet you and to feel inspired to bring you onto the podcast. And I would very much like to meet up again soon and continue the conversation and to listen to what's going on. I'm very intrigued, and I hope that one of the things that could be the what comes next would be you and I can meet up again soon and talk and have another meaningful conversation and drill down and in different directions. So it's been an absolute pleasure. I always let my guest have the last word. I think you've just had it. So with that, my deep appreciation for your time, and it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.